You'll find on your chair there tonight a little sheet of paper that you can take notes on as we'll be talking about life objective. So if you have a little sheet of paper and a pencil, I would encourage you to jot down some notes. We do have some good news for you later about the trip, so just relax. We'll talk about life objective for a few minutes. Now, what is an objective? And then we'll define that, what a life objective is, but if you look in the dictionary, the word objective means something towards which effort is directed. It's what an objective is. Something towards which effort is directed. That's what an objective is. So a life objective, and let me give you just a working definition of a life objective, would be that one thing in life, to which you exert your supreme effort. That one thing in life towards which you will exert your supreme effort. And so as we talk about a life objective now, as you form your life objective, it will be that one thing to which you're going to give your supreme effort. Now you'll have the privilege of doing a lot of things in life, but there needs to be that out in front of you to which you will give your life. That will be the thing to which you will direct your supreme effort. Now, what are the purposes of a life objective? Well, there may be many, but just quickly, let's talk about a few. The first objective, I think, is to help you think through and decide what you will do with your life. Help you to think through and to decide what you will do with your life. That's one of the first purposes of a life objective, is to think through, to give some thought. See, most people move out in life, and then life comes at them, and then, without ever clearly having thought about what they're going to do with their life, then they're forced to make decisions. And they're already out in the mainstream of life, and now they're trying to decide what they really want to do. It is so much better to decide what you want to do with your life before you get out there and let things begin to buffet you around. And see, if you know where you're going and what you want to give your life to, it will help you in many, many ways. Now, a second thing a life objective will do, it's a tool by which you can evaluate. It's a tool by which you can evaluate your life and activities. A life objective is a tool. And it is very helpful to me at times to sit down with my life objective and to evaluate what I'm doing. You know, for example, every once in a while I'll get a call to go somewhere and speak. And just because it's a call to go somewhere and speak doesn't necessarily mean I should do it. And at the time, as I think about what my objective is and what I'm trying to accomplish in life, many of those things that I have to turn down. Because right now, they do not fit into what I'm trying to do. Now, some of those I take. But that is a tool which helps me to evaluate my activities. I mean, if I know what my objective is, then I can evaluate what I'm doing and see if those activities are helping me to accomplish that objective. Now, you know, there's some ministries and some situations in which if you're just active, that's okay. I mean, as long as you're busy. I mean, it's just, you know, some people don't see one bit of difference between having a BSU choir and having BSU Bible studies. See? I mean, you look at a lot of what we do in the name of Christianity doesn't really help you to prepare to live when you get on this campus. And I've said this, I'm not saying it out of school, I said it to a lot of youth directors. Now, for example, let's just think. If a youth director's primary job is to work with the youth, and that's his objective, to try to win and disciple young people. Now, let's suppose he's also going to help adults, but let's evaluate now his activities in light of what he's doing. Let's first of all look at his schedule. Where are most youth directors during the day from 9 to 5 o'clock? Where are they? They're at church. Now, where are the young people that they're hired to work with? School, right? I mean, you don't have to be very smart to figure that out. See, most students are almost totally unavailable from about 8:30 in the morning till around 3:45 in the afternoon, somewhere around there. But where's the youth director? He's up at church. Okay? The kids get out of school about 3:30 or 3:45. And now they're available. Now, where does he go at 5 o'clock? Home. Now, what does he do at night? Well, maybe several things. Some of it's working with youth. But I mean, you know, if the Southern Baptist Convention would take 30 minutes to think about that, it would totally revolutionize the youth program in this country. And that's all it'd take. I mean, just 30 minutes would change the whole convention as far as the way we operate. Isn't that amazing? I mean, it is absolutely amazing if we'd think. And that's one of the things that we try to say to you again and again. You have got to learn to think. Now, if he just had the objective, if he could just see, what am I hired to do? Work with young people. That is my objective. Then he might think, where are they? And how could I use my time to be with them? Now, that's not meant as a critical statement. But I never cease to be amazed at what we do. Like, for example, another time in my life, I was approached by a church staff person and said, Max, will you play on our church softball team this summer? I said, well, now let me see if I understand you. You want me here on Sunday night, is that right? And he said, oh, yeah, we want you here on Sunday night. I said, I normally am. I said, you want me here on Wednesday night for prayer meeting, is that right? He said, well, yeah, you're BSU director. And I said, well, I normally am, or was at that time. And I said, you want me here on Monday night for church visitation, is that right? And he said, well, yeah, we like you here on Monday night. And I said, now you want me here two more nights? Oh, that's 5 out of 7. I said, I'm married. I got a kid. I'm not going to give the church 5 nights out of 7 for that kind of activity. Now, you see, some people have never stopped to think that through. Now, I'm not against church softball if that's what you want to do, if you've got 2 nights a week to give. But you see, a lot of people, as long as you're active, they never stop to evaluate what they're doing. Now, one of the things a life objective will do, it'll be an evaluative tool. Evaluate what you're doing in the light of what you're trying to accomplish. Now, businessmen have to do that all the time. We could learn so much from them. They have to evaluate if what they're doing is paying off. If not, you go broke. Okay? So that's one of the great purposes of a tool. The third thing I'd say is just to give clear direction. Once you've thought it all through, you've evaluated, it can help get you back on target and can give you clear direction. Now, there are probably some other things, but at least those would help. All right, now what are the elements of a life objective? I think one thing that some of the elements, first of all, it needs to be comprehensive. You don't want a life objective that you can state it, and yet it really doesn't involve all of life. It doesn't involve what you're primarily doing. So it needs to be comprehensive. Number two, it needs to be effective. We're not just, if we come up with the wrong life objective and it doesn't help us and it's not really effective, then that would not be useful. And the third thing is it needs to be biblical. If you're going to come up with a life objective, it needs to be biblical. Now, tonight I'm going to share with you my life objective, and I want to talk about it, and then maybe this would be something that you could use. You may want to adopt it as your own. You may want to give some thought to your own and struggle with it yourself and see what you want to do. But here it is. It's to know, love, and glorify God and be used of Him to raise up qualified laborers in significant numbers as fast as possible to help fulfill the Great Commission and to lead my family to do the same. Now, it's okay to use a long sentence. You know, you look in the Bible, sometime Paul did that. So, we've tried to make it comprehensive and yet biblical. Now, I'll flip over on the back and there's some room under each one of these phrases for you just to take some notes. Now, the first thing, as I mentioned, is I want to know God. You know, in John 17:3, it says, this is life eternal, that we might know Thee, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom Thou hast sent. But as you know also, meeting Jesus Christ is not really knowing Him in an intimate way. many of you have come to know Him. There was a day in your life in which you placed your faith in Him and you came to know Him. And that's great. But it's not enough just to know Him. We need to know Him in an intimate way. And after Paul had been a Christian for many years, one day he wrote in Philippians 3:10, that I might know Him. The longing of his heart was really know Him in the power of His resurrection and the fellowship of His suffering. You know, before David died, he shared with Solomon, his son, and challenged him in 1 Chronicles 28:9. He said, but know thou the God of your fathers, and serve Him with a perfect heart and a willing mind. If you seek Him, He will be found of you. And he said, if you forsake Him, He will cast you off forever. In Jeremiah 29, verse 12 and 13, he said, then shall you go and pray to Me, and you shall seek Me and find Me when you search for Me with all your heart. And you know, if I could recommend one thing to you primarily, it would be to get to know your God, spend time with Him, read the Bible, go to conferences, do any and everything you can to get to know God. Now, there are no shortcuts. You know, much of what's happening in the Christian world today that's getting people fouled up in their theology is because they're looking for shortcuts. They want to have this experience where they can arrive with a great knowledge of God and a great maturity without having to struggle with having a quiet time and memorizing verses and reading the Bible and praying and going to church and disciplining themselves. But there are no shortcuts, so quit looking for them. Just get your Bible and in the morning get up and read it. And there are no shortcuts, really, to getting to know God. Set your heart to know Him. You know, in Daniel 10:12, it says, they that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. In Psalms 108:13, it says, they that know their God shall do valiantly. In every way you can, get to know God. The Bible says in Psalms 33:11, the counsel of the Lord stands forever, the thoughts of His heart to every generation. And God will reveal what is on His heart to the people, some people in this generation, and it will be the people who really come to know Him. You know, there's a very sad verse in the Bible. It's 2 Chronicles 12:14. It said, Rehoboam, it says of Rehoboam, he did evil because he did not set his heart to seek the Lord. Now, as you study that passage, it didn't say that he did anything bad in the things that he didn't murder anybody or do those things right at that time. It said, though, that he did not set his heart to seek the Lord. He did evil because he didn't set his heart to seek the Lord. Not seeking the Lord is evil. It really is. Now, in America, we think if you just don't do bad things, you're okay. But if you do not seek the Lord with your heart, you're involved in what the Bible calls evil. Now, the second thing we want to do is to love God. A man came to Jesus on one occasion and says, Master, which is a great commandment in the law? And you remember what Jesus said to him? Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all your heart, with all your mind, with all your soul. This is the first and great commandment. And he said, the second is like to it. You're to love your neighbor as yourself. But love God with all your heart, mind, and soul, to really love Him. And you'll not love Him if you don't really get to know Him. You know, in Revelation 2, chapter 2, it says, I know your deeds, and I know your toil, and I know your perseverance, and I know that you have endured many things for my name's sake. And he said, you've not grown weary, but he said, I have this against you, that you have left your first love. And you know, that's awfully easy, very, very easy to do. You can get busy, you've got many things to do, and over a period of time, you find that the love relationship with the Lord is gone. And it takes time to cultivate that. You find that out once you meet someone that you want to marry, or you're in love with someone, or even after you're married. It takes time to cultivate a relationship. And it takes time to cultivate your relationship to the Lord. Revelation 3:15 and 16, Jesus said, I know your deeds, that you're neither hot nor cold, and I wish you were hot or cold, because I'll spew you out of my mouth. These people had lost that very first love which they had for the Lord. You know, after Jesus spent 3 years with Peter, it's interesting, the one thing he wanted to know and he talked with Peter about was his love for him. He says, Peter, do you love me? And three times he asked him that. He didn't ask him about his obedience and a lot of other things, but Peter, do you love me? Now, love is expressed in obedience. In John 21:15, as Jesus taught with Peter, you'll see that. And in John 14:21, he that has my commandments and keeps them, he it is that loves me. You might want to jot down 1 John 5:3 and 2 John 1:6. And all of these verses say basically, he that, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. And so obedience is a way we measure our love. And Jesus said on one occasion, if any man comes to me and doesn't hate his father and mother and his wife and his children and houses and land and all these things, if you're not willing to forsake those, he said, you cannot be my disciple. And here Jesus is getting over one central idea. I want your supreme devotion. Your father, your mother, your wife, your children, your job, your land, nothing, nothing in this world is to have your supreme obedience. I am the only one, and I want your full attention. I want your devotion. And as we love Him, then certainly we will have plenty of space in our life to love others, because that is the second commandment. And then to glorify God. You know, one of the things about the Bible is so terrific is God has written to us and given us direction and instruction, and it's practical for our everyday lives. You see, it's not that you can go to church or read the Bible or something and that's glorifying God. See, 1 Corinthians 10:31 says, where you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. I mean, you can eat to the glory of God. You can drink to the glory of God. You can go to class to the glory of God. You can study to the glory of God. And whatever you do it because the desire of your heart is to bring honor and glory to Him. And so you don't have to compartmentalize your life into those things that are spiritual and then those things that aren't. Whatever you do, you see, it's not what you do, it's why you do it. It's the origin. It's not what you're doing, but why are you doing this? If you're studying because God sent you here to be a student, you want to be a good steward, you want to honor Him with your life, then that brings honor and glory to God for you to study, because that's a task He's given you to do, and you're doing it with your heart. And so whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. You can mow the lawn to the glory of God. Colossians 3:23 says, whatever you do, do it heartily as unto the Lord and not unto men. See, you don't just study, or you should not, just because a professor gives you assignments. You ought to study because it's your desire to learn and to equip the mind which God gave you so that you can be a good servant of His. And let me tell you, if there's anything that's needed in the 20th century, it's Christians who can move out into this world and think through the hard issues and make an impact in our world. And we're going to have Christians who have keen minds and who've trained themselves and will pay a price if we're going to move out into the 20th century and really make an impact. And then our desire is to be used of Him. Unless God uses us, I mean, nothing's going to happen. We can do nothing. Jesus said in John 15:5, for without me you can do nothing. And that's right. Unless God lives in us and empowers us, nothing we can do is going to amount to anything. And Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15:10, I am what I am by the grace of God, and His grace, which was granted to me, was not bestowed upon me in vain. He said, I labored more abundantly than all, speaking of all the other apostles, but he said, yet not I, but it was the grace of God which was with me. And so Paul said, I labored, and yet it wasn't me, it was God doing it. In Philippians 2:13, he said, it is God who works in you both to will and to do of His good pleasure. And so our desire is to be used of God. Now notice, first of all, we said it's to know, love, and glorify Him. All those things are focused on God. That's where our first allegiance should be, is our relationship to God. And then, once we set out to know Him, to love Him, to glorify Him, then we desire to be used of Him. Now, if you go out in the world and your desire is just to be used of God and you're not willing to take the time to get to know Him, not willing to develop the relationship so there's a real love relationship with the Lord, then you're not going to accomplish much when it comes to being used of Him. You know, Vance Havner used to say, And he was talking to seminary students, young preachers. He said, you know, I know a lot of young preacher boys, and they have gold fever, but they don't have much digging spirit. And he was talking about how they wanted to be used of God, but they're not willing to pay the price. And he used to say, you know, you're always praying, God, use me, God, use me. He said, you just get usable and God will wear you out. And that's right. See, God desires to use us, but first there needs to be that quality of life where we know Him and we love Him, and the goal of our life is to glorify Him, and then God can take us and do something with us. So we want to be used of Him to raise up. Now, to raise up, you know, disciples, as you know, Walt Hendrickson has written a book called Disciples Are Made, Not Born. Disciples aren't born. I mean, nobody is born a disciple. There's never been one born yet other than Jesus. I mean, nobody's born a disciple. You have to be converted and totally your whole life. Jesus said you must be born again before you can ever become a disciple. And so disciples are made. They're not born, they're made. And God takes the raw product of a human life, and normally the way disciples are best made is when another life or other lives, other believers come in contact with that life, begin to share the Lord with that person, show him how to live, lead him to the point where he knows Christ, and then show that person how to walk with God. Now see, we can all be involved in that. You know, Dr. Robert Coleman said the beautiful thing about disciple making, it's not limited to a few. Even Billy Graham, he can go around the world preaching and he can see new converts and things, but he can disciple a few. Even Billy Graham can only disciple a few. A homemaker with a young baby in the home can still disciple a neighbor or someone. He says that's a beautiful thing about disciple making. Everyone can have a part in it. And we can. We can all have a part in making disciples. We can be used of God to raise up qualified laborers. And don't ever forget that. The raw product to make a disciple is a people. I mean, if you can find a person, you know, people. That's what disciples are made out of. You know, you don't have to have clay. You don't have to have skills. You don't have to have a lot of, a set of carpenter's tools or something. But you've got to find a person and there begin to share your life with that person. And God uses people to share with other people to make disciples. And then we want to raise up qualified laborers. We're not just interested in people saying they become Christians. As you well know, in America today, as probably few other nations in the world, we have an abundance of people who name the name of Christ. And yet we have some giant problems in this land also. And many, many people that say they know Christ, and yet there's not a quality about their lives. And they're certainly not laborers. They may know the Lord, but they're not laboring. They're not out in the harvest fields of the world trying to reach people. And so we want to raise up a quality of labor. We have the opportunity to mark people's lives, that we want a quality about our work. And so one of the things that we always have to be interested in is quality. 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 Therefore, we cannot ignore what it takes to build quality into people's lives. You know, if you look at furniture or nearly anything in this country that's really worthwhile, much of it that's really good is handcrafted or it's hand-built. I mean, you know, you can go to some of these places and buy furniture. A guy told me some time ago he had gone up here to one of the places and bought a new couch, and they were carrying it into his home, and they pulled the whole end of it, the whole arm, the whole end pulled off going through the door. I mean, you know, it really wasn't quality. And somewhere along the line that we've gotten the idea that we can just mass produce quality. And usually quality is not mass produced in anything. You know, I'm reading a fascinating book by a fellow who is Mr. Neiman of Neiman Marcus in Dallas. He gave most of his life to traveling around the world to find the best in quality of any and everything. And occasionally, if you're in Dallas, just go into Neiman Marcus. It's fun. I mean, don't expect to buy anything, but it's fun to go in and look. And he wrote a book called The Quest for the Best. And one of the things that he said is elegance died in the 19th century. And you, most of you living in this world, you don't know what elegance is, because elegance has already died and you've never seen it. You've seen some good quality, and right now there's a standard of living in America that most of the world, I mean, it's lifted the whole mass of people, but most people don't really know what elegance and what superior quality is. And he says he would go around the world to find the best leather suitcase made anywhere in the world. And regardless of price, he wanted the best suitcase that was made anywhere in the world. And he gave his life, and he says, you know, for 40 years he traveled around the world looking for different things. Now, I'm not advocating that everything has to be elegant, but I am saying that there needs to be a quality about our work. And I want to encourage you at this point. You know, some of you, many of you are on different teams, your own freshman ministry team, and that takes a part of 3 nights a week. And boy, I tell you, just like some of you, you've got tests maybe tomorrow, or you're going to Glen Eyrie, and you've got other tests when you get back, and you pay a price. And boy, I know sometimes that gets tough. And you really think, some of you are out here, you're already thinking, boy, when it comes next year, I'm not going to be on the ministry team. I mean, that's Friday night, 10 out of 15 nights out of the semester. And good grief, you know, they start at 5:30 and you don't get through till 9. And you think about those things. Yeah, that's right. You know why? Because before God, we hope you're a better quality than most of the people where you grew up. Because let me tell you, right today it takes 43 Southern Baptists a year to win one person to the Lord. Let me tell you, if you're not different than your older brothers and sisters, most of this world is going to go to hell. I mean, it is. And it takes time to build quality. And you have to be hammered on, and you have to be pushed. And man, sometimes you don't like it. I know you don't like it. I don't like it either. I mean, I hadn't even started packing for tomorrow because there hadn't been time. But you get pushed, and you get pushed. And let me tell you, that's part of making quality. You don't make quality by just coming in and preaching to people and say, God bless you. Now, there are places where you can go and get that if you want it. But let me tell you, that doesn't build quality. It takes time to build quality. It takes effort. It takes struggle. And you get out there in the dorms, and you knock on doors, and you know sometimes that people don't want to see you coming. And that's right. They're not at a point where they want to see you coming, and they don't care. And if you don't care, they're not going to make it. And it takes time to build quality. And one of the things we're interested in is quality labor.